listening to Road to Black Tech Week, where culture, capital, and creativity collide. And today, I'm bringing you a powerful conversation with Denzel Porteous, CEO Emeritus at Pride Fund One and Executive Director of Stonewall Columbus. He's a force at the intersection of queerness, Blackness, and entrepreneurship. Denzel gets real about building his thesis, why he does the work by showing up fully and authentically in every room. We talk identity, leadership, emotional labor, and what it takes to carve out space. This one's about purpose, power, and choosing to live in your truth, loud and clear. Black Tech Week 2025 goes live July 14th through the 16th in Cincinnati. Head to blacktechweek.com and get in the room. Let's get into it.
All right. Hi, everyone. I hope you guys are having a great time at Black Tech Week. We're here to discuss finding your thesis. Growing up, a thesis statement was a sentence you placed in the introduction paragraph to explain the main argument that your essay wishes to address, as well as a counterargument you want to explore and disprove to further your own argument. While there isn't an essay due, finding your thesis and knowing what your startup's mission is allows you to stay focused on your goals. Denzel Porteous is the CEO of Pride Fund, whose mission is to empower the LGBTQ plus community through venture capital. The founder of DePorteous Consulting, a consulting firm that supports nonprofits and currently serves as services of Stonewall Columbus, a nonprofit organization supporting Central Ohio's LGBTQ community. Porteous is passionate about helping organizations and people find success through strategic planning and building and motivating teams. Porteous will discuss his methodology in finding ways and creating your own thesis so you can achieve your mission. Hello, and welcome to Black Tech Week, everyone, and Denzel. Please begin by telling us about yourself and what led you to Black Tech Week.
Wonderful, thank you. Well, thank you for that gracious introduction. It's a pleasure for me to be here. I wasn't able to make it last year. I was traveling, and this year I'm in town, so able to come down from Columbus, so not too far away. I don't know, telling me about myself and what led me to Black Tech Week. Well, last year I couldn't make it. I really was hoping to be a part of the community for the first time as a CEO of a LGBTQ venture capital fund, one of few in the country. But I think it was just an ask from Alexis that said, can you come on down and be a part of this program and share a bit of your story and tell us about, you know, what your passions are and how you got here. That's sort of the quick and easy. I know we go through some more questions later, so.
Yeah, I know we have a lot to get through, and hopefully we have enough time for some questions at the end. But as a Black gay man, you exist at the intersection of Blackness and queerness, experiencing both homophobia and racism. How do these marginalized identities that exist within you shape who you are?
I know we got these questions ahead of time, so I had some time to reflect on them, but they still sort of sit heavy. I mean, it's hard to sort of not walk out of my home or exist in the world without these identities, which are part of who I am, guiding the daily way I live my life. I think at some point in my life, I realized that in order to be my most authentic self, I had to fully live who I was and exist as who I am. I think everyone sees I'm a Black person. I think that's easy, right? Like someone, I walk into a room, I lead with my Blackness. But my queerness is something that I don't have to lead with. It is a silent identity. But I think when I understood and understand that being able to, again, live in your truth, there's a certain amount of power in that. And these identities are identities that have been challenged, living in systems that weren't built for us in either way. Are sort of motivators for the work that I do and how I live my life. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that living in your truth is so important. So it's good to hear that over your lifespan, you found a way to feel comfortable in that truth.
It took a while.
Yeah, for many of us, I think it does. How has being part of the LGBTQ plus community shaped your view on Blackness, and vice versa? How does being Black shape the way you view queerness?
Wow. You know, I think it's been a struggle as a Black person growing up in America from a Caribbean family. I was always told that a gay identity or queerness was something that didn't exist. You didn't mess around with boys, right? Like that was just sort of a, you acted like a, I don't want to say the words because they're derogatory, but you were, that identity was not something that existed in Caribbean culture. And so for me, as a Black person, that was just, being gay was not okay. Simply that was it, full stop.
Yeah.
And conversely, in the queer community for so long, marginalized identities like Black people were not included in the fight. They weren't considered. They weren't talked about. They weren't seen in spaces. And so it's neither one of my identities welcomed the other part of my identity.
And I guess we'll get into it a little bit more as we talk. But I do want you to dig deeper, you know, into how you, I guess, evolved and felt more comfortable being in between those two intersections.
I'm still evolving.
How do you define intersectionality and fit it within your practice at Stonewall Columbus? And maybe you can touch a little bit more about like what you do at Stonewall as well.
You know, I think intersectionality is sort of, what is that thing when we learn, diagrams, convectional, what are those things? Diagrams. I can't think of the name of it. Venn diagram. Thank you. Right? Like intersectionality is like a Venn diagram, right? And you think about sort of all the pieces of yourself that make you who you are. And there are these intersections that start to overlap and there's no way that you can pull them apart. They are intrinsically connected. And I think when we think about intersectionality, at least for me, that's how, you know, my Blackness and my gayness and my queerness and all these other things, my fatherness, right, as a parent, as a dad, you know, as a married person, like all these things intersect in such a way that sort of trying to dissect one from the other would seem impossible. And I think when we think about sort of these spaces at Stonewall, for example, which is the LGBTQ center in Columbus, Ohio, or for Central Ohio, quite frankly, you know, we understand that queer identities come from a variety of places. Queer identities literally exist in everywhere. And so being able to understand that we need to create spaces where those intersectional identities can come together and find other aspects of yourself to be seen, to be supported, to create simply space for that intersection to exist and exist in a safer space. Yeah. I think that's really what it's about.
Yeah, no, totally understand that. So I don't know if any of you guys have watched Denzel's Hulu special, but he talked about the fact that early on in your life, you used to code switch often. It sounds like you tried to pull apart your intersections and kind of live in different spaces without, you know,
and that was lighting often
all
for
of
the,
who you were.
And that was often for the comfort of other people, right?
Yeah.
Like in my Black spaces, I couldn't be very queer because that was to make them feel comfortable. In my queer spaces, I couldn't be very Black, you know. And I think that was ultimately what it was for me, right? So having to do that to be able to navigate sort of these places that, again, structures that weren't necessarily built for me or people like me, was something that I did for a long time. And that rub was is challenging, right? It's like it's like cheating, but it is like cheating, right? You feel guilty. Like you literally feel guilty when you do something wrong, right? So, you know, I can remember in school, like if you were cheating, right? Like doing something wrong, you got caught and you felt guilty and you knew, because you knew it was wrong. You knew that what you did was wrong. You wanted to be your full self or you wanted to be able to be truthful in that moment to say, I didn't know it, I didn't understand it. But that's, you know, that space wasn't something that we've always had. That space is something that's new for us as a society, being able to say you are allowed to bring your full self to these spaces. And if those people don't feel comfortable, then that's their problem.
Yeah. I guess I'll take a moment to share something about myself here because I think it resonates with the conversation. But I'm a Ugandan girl who grew up in Madison, Wisconsin. And so I wasn't Black American and I wasn't white. And I was also a Black swimmer. So it was really difficult to find acceptance, and we'll talk about that more as we continue in this discussion. But that lack of feeling accepted by people resulted in a lot of anxiety and stress, and it took several years for me to accept myself for the diversity of experiences and culture that I have within me. And I think that that was really catalyzed when I moved to Washington, D.C., which is, you know, a melting pot of different cultures and different people where you can feel accepted. So I was wondering for you, like, what was that environment that made you feel like you didn't have to code switch anymore?
So I want to lean into your experience for a moment, because I was born in the Caribbean, and even in America, right, there's still this hesitancy of blackness, and understanding that that's a diaspora of identity. And so even within the black community, right, as I got older and people started to realize that I wasn't black American, these questions of my blackness came into play as well. So even there, I found myself code switching. And I think it was probably in college. I went to a small liberal arts college here in Ohio. And I was, you know, I used to always say when I started there, I felt like a raisin in a bowl of cream of wheat. Because I stood out that much, right? Like, I stood out so much. And when I wanted to be a part of the Black Student Union, they didn't understand why I wanted to be a part of the Black Student Union. I said, well, I'm a Black person. I think I'm from here. And it was sort of their desire to disassociate with me as a Caribbean person who was also queer that made me realize that I just had to live into my truth. Because there were always going to be places and spaces that didn't want me to be there or didn't understand who I was. And I felt like it was my responsibility to demonstrate the reasons why I should be there and be in those spaces.
Yeah. Oh, thank you for sharing that. So you are currently CEO of Pride Fund One, which seeks to empower LGBTQ+ communities through venture capital. How do you believe venture capital can empower the LGBTQ+ community?
You know, I think the joy of venture capital is that we can empower a lot of communities, right? We understand that money matters. As much as we don't want to accept it and really think about it, when someone believes in your idea, when they believe in you, they put energy, time, whatever resources they have into you to develop you, to make sure that you, the identity, the thought, whatever, becomes something greater. And I think what we understand is that less than 1% of LGBTQ identities and ventures are funded and getting funding in this space. And so we know that money matters, right? The more we're able to uplift identities through venture to create spaces where they can step into and demonstrate their capacity, we know that there can be success, right? So it's increasing the dollars that are going to LGBTQ entrepreneurs and ventures in that space, but also making sure that our stories are being told, that when we have opportunities and moments like this to represent our intersectional stories and how they exist in places that are important, that they're being told as well.
No, that's very powerful. And I think that for me as a venture capitalist, I have a similar mission in the way that I try to deploy capital. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a standard demographic that usually does get capital, but there's so many people that have untapped potential that just don't have access. And so when I see that potential in someone that might typically not fit a standard demographic, I definitely try my best to give them an opportunity to display their potential. And I think that what you're doing with Pride Fund One is an example of, you know, people that typically aren't represented getting an opportunity and you finding that potential.
Thank you. Well, I'm glad you're doing it too. So thanks.
So besides capital, how does Pride Fund One support the community? And as CEO, what programs and initiatives do you plan to introduce to continue to support?
That's a big question. You know, well, we are a small team, so I think as our team grows and we develop in terms of what we want to do, we'll think about sort of really concrete programming. I think one of the things that Pride Fund does and does well and superbly is build relationships and connections throughout community, building these networks that didn't exist before, the networks that advantage those who have networks, right? So when you think about the fact that when you're looking at venture capital and you're thinking, oh yes, well, this person went to Stanford, Yale, and Harvard, and so they're getting the traditional like investment because they know the networks. I think what we're doing at the Pride Fund is creating those networks for LGBTQ entrepreneurs where they didn't exist before. We have found that there are lots of pockets of people doing this work, but they weren't connected to each other. They weren't sharing stories or resources. They weren't building this network of power to enable them to do the work that they needed to do. And so one of the things that actually I appreciate, and I keep pointing over here because some of the folks from the Pride Fund stuff are over here. I think one of the things that we really were excited about and what we talk a lot about are words of pride. And so it's an opportunity for us to be able to uplift the stories of LGBTQ entrepreneurs around the country and talk about what struggles they're we're having, but also, you know, the joys of what that means, you know, and being able to be a part of that. I think that's something that's new and different, and sharing those stories in social and digital forms has been, I think, empowering for the community.
Awesome. So if someone's interested in getting tapped into these networks, where do they go?
They can go to pride.vc. Okay. Everything is right there. So pride.vc, which I think is also a cool URL for our venture, right? So pride.vc.
Perfect. So furthermore, as a Black gay man, how does this work that you do at Pride, like how does you as a Black gay man shape the work that you do at Pride Fund One?
You know, I think about the LGBTQ rights movement, you know, and sort of this notion of the inception being 1969 and the Stonewall uprisings and the Stonewall riots. But what we realize, I think, in that particular moment is that the 1960s were also the Black rights movement and what was happening then. And LGBTQ folks can't really sort of think about liberation and think about their rights movement without understanding what the Black rights movement was about and still is about today and freedom and what that looks like. And a lot of the concepts of the LGBTQ rights movement came from the Black rights movement, came from community building and galvanizing and understanding that you have to work with the church and outside of the church and in the community to be able to change hearts and minds about who we are, but understanding that our rights should be there. And so I think when we look at the Pride Fund and how I bring my identity as a Black queer person to that, all of that knowledge comes with me in terms of how we walk into spaces and how we present ourselves. But already I think that the challenge is equally there because there are not a lot of Black and brown faces in venture. So I think for me, there's that duality of understanding that this is important, right? Because not only am I bringing, you know, LGBTQ identities to venture and bringing Black and brown faces to venture and talking about what that means. So, you know, here's that notion again of intersectionality. One cannot be disconnected from the other if I'm living in my authentic and full true self.
Yeah, extremely powerful. So just a moment. Sorry about this, guys.
I know there's so many back and forth.
Okay, we're switching to the cards.
Okay.
Something happened to my phone. Sorry about this, everyone.
Look, we still hold on to paper. Like, I just like it's a good thing.
All right, so let's switch to Deportius Consulting. Tell us why you decided to create your own consulting firm, and what do you feel like your firm does differently than other firms?
So I think it actually was sort of thinking about my thesis that motivated me to ultimately step into consulting or step into consulting full time. So I've probably been doing consulting, nonprofit consulting, management consulting since about 2015. And it was actually in January of 2020 when I quit my job and said, I'm gonna, you know, go into it full time and not sort of, you know, dance around halfway into it. And I think for me, what I realized was that as I was working with so many consulting firms, I never saw myself. I never saw myself in any of the C-level positions. I didn't see myself in any of the manager positions, you know. And if I saw myself in any sort of these junior level positions, it seemed like they were, you know, an intern or they were here for a minute and then they were gone. And so for me, I wanted to be able to ensure that as the projects that I were working on across the different industries I existed in, that folks like me were part of that work, and that there wasn't this necessity to sort of pinpoint us into segments of where we could work, right? We shouldn't only have to work at Black firms to be able to do the work that we wanted to do. We should be able to be welcome in these spaces at some of these large firms that are doing amazing work. And so that was important for me. And so stepping into sort of my own consulting work, it allowed me then to really give that sort of feedback to folks as I was doing that work. You know, stepping into higher education organizations, I've been talking about, you know, the systems that they've created to replicate themselves that won't allow them to be able to think about diversity the way that they really want to, or to think about inclusion the way that they really want to. I believe in a concept of, you know, if you practice inclusion, diversity will come. And so a lot of these spaces that were looking to, you know, expand their outreach to different markets or communities kept thinking about it from sort of this very focused space of what do we do to engage this one group versus thinking about, let's just start thinking about inclusive practices that will then make people feel comfortable being in these spaces. And maybe some of our employees now would stay around, or those who we are trying to get in front of would think about being a part of our groups. And so that's sort of central to the work that the consulting company that I sort of put on hold does, is that we practice inclusion first in all the work that we do. So if there is a senior level executive who needs you know, executive coaching, there's time spent talking about sort of inclusive practices, right? Like what does that look like in their work? You know, if we're looking at a nonprofit is looking at raising funds in new markets, we think about, well, what inclusive practices are you bringing to that work? Are you looking at language that you use to be more inclusive? You know, simply are the forms that you're asking people to donate with more inclusive? Do they present, you know, pronouns in a certain way that make people feel like, hey, this space is open and welcoming for me? So I think, you know, that's sort of the uniqueness of the work that I do, is that I really am forward about inclusion being center to success.
No, I think one thing that you said there that was extremely powerful is that if you are inclusive, diversity will come. And given I talked a little bit about like my background, you know, in Wisconsin and stuff like that, so I often knew what it felt like to be alone. I might be like that kid in the corner of the cafeteria or like in a teacher's classroom that didn't have anyone to go to. So I often, one of my big mottos is also being inclusive. Instead of like going to that person who's the life of the party, I will spot out that person that seems to be in the back of the corner alone and find a way to engage them to make them feel included. So I think that that work is very powerful and necessary. To follow on to the fact that you said you put your consulting firm on hold, obviously you're doing Pride Fund, you were doing your consulting work and the work at Stonewall. Wanted you to dig a little bit deeper into what it's like to wear so many different hats, and it seems like you've had to prioritize. So tell us more about that process of deciding like where you wanted to spend your time.
So, you know, I was sitting here and I just realized, and I don't even know if there's a question that says, what is your thesis? I literally was just thinking about this. And I think, again, it's centering around the thesis. And so I recorded myself as I was driving down the thesis to remind myself, but I know what it is. But, you know, I often think, well, my thesis is simply this. I'm not trying to get choked up about it, because to me, it's more.
This is a safe space.
No, I know it is. So, you know, I always think about what I didn't have when I was a young person, the people that I didn't have in the room for me, the things that I didn't see in those spaces. And ultimately, that's what drives me. So I want to ensure that I'm leaving the world that I came into better than I found it by being the person that I didn't have as a young person. And so that's sort of what motivates me and drives me each and every time when I make a decision, right? When I think about, is this going to make the world a better place? Am I leaving it better than I found it? And then am I doing something that younger me didn't have? And how would that be? And so, you know, when I think about how the intersection of the work happens, you know, all of these spaces were places where younger me didn't see myself. When I think about the fact that, you know, I sit on the board of the Human Rights Campaign, which is the largest LGBTQ civil rights organization in the country internationally, and it wasn't until 3 years ago, the organization is, what, 43 now? It wasn't until 3 years ago that they were the first LGBTQ organization to have a black person leading the organization. And I thought that was astounding, because here I was at whatever age I was, no, I'm 42. Here I was at 42, and it was like I hadn't seen this for 40-something years. And so for me, you know, saying yes to the Pride Fund, saying yes to Stonewall, saying yes to stepping out as an independent consultant was, again, doing that, right? Realizing that all of these initiatives were ultimately trying to leave the world better And then I didn't see myself in these spaces. I never thought I would see myself in these spaces. I wouldn't imagine that, you know, Black young queer me at 5 and 6 and 7, understanding and learning identity, growing up in New York City, that at one point in time I'd be sitting in these spaces, that I would be representative and reflective of something for someone else. So that's how I, you know, that's how I prioritize, right? Like if the work of the work does the most work, with the least amount of effort, then I'm going to probably say yes to that first, right? Like, yeah. If that opportunity to speak to the most people and reach the most, I'm probably going to say yes to that first.
Mm-hmm. Something that I wanted to touch on there was, like, your why is very clear, right? You want to build a world that you didn't have. And I think that for anybody out there who's building something, you know, having your why is really foundational to what will motivate you to continue to go forward when things are difficult, right? Because doing so much isn't easy. It's not easy on you, physically, mentally, but like that foundational drive is there.
It's not easy on my family, which I just, to take that moment, right, and acknowledge it, right? Like I'm married, I have a partner, we have a 6-year-old child. And it's also that notion of, even driving down here today, right? She's out of school, and so we're splitting time. This morning I was up with her watching TV, making sure she's, you know, doing her schoolwork. But then hey, Dad's got to go, right? Like, so it's even understanding that there's prioritization over your sort of your family. But the reality is that's part of the story, right? Like the opportunity to sit here and talk about the fact that I am a queer Black person who is married and has a child. That's, again, not something that I saw growing up. And that's a story that maybe other people haven't heard before. And so the impact is that much greater in terms of being able to make that yes.
Yeah. And one other thing that I want to bring to light is when I watched your Hulu special, you talked about your mother and how she was able to give, like, and she continued to give and give and give. And I'm seeing that in you in the way that you're articulating what you do. So do you think that a lot of that comes from her?
I'm gonna have to say yes. I mean, I think
I think you have to say yes.
Yeah, I mean, we follow the examples that we see, and that's my foundational example, right? Like, she was a single Black woman who brought her kids from Jamaica to have a better life. You know, didn't go to college, earned her GED. You know, I remember sitting in the back of the classroom with her. She went to night school at NYU in New York City. You know, so I mean, I think yes, right? Like, she never. When I hear people say, you have the capacity. Like this is someone that I watched. She had the capacity, even as she was, as she lay dying, which I think is a poem or a book. I can't remember which one it is, but like literally, you know, as my mother was laying dying, like she still had the capacity to be a mother, to talk to us, to tell us that we're going to be okay, to continue to push us, to motivate us. So I would only imagine that for me, that has to be right. The model that I saw, and there's no other way.
Yeah. I'm just doing a quick time check. Okay, we're okay on time. So let's kind of take it back to your childhood a little bit. So in an interview with Perez Pratt Harrison at Iban Man, you discussed growing up in a Pentecostal Caribbean household and being taught that being gay wasn't okay and struggling with your identity, which we've discussed. Now your queerness as well as your Blackness are central to most of the work that you do. How did you get to a place of acceptance? You talked a little bit about college and stuff like that, but like, let's really get into that catalyzing moment that made you feel like, I am proud of me.
I honestly think I'm still working on it, right? I think full acceptance of yourself is a journey. It's a process. There's a lot of unlearning that I have to do. I posted something about it this morning, right? I don't like to see myself on screen. I don't like to hear myself. And I think, you know, I realized it was because I was taught not to love myself, the self that I see, the self that I hear, right? Like growing up, it was like, oh, your voice is this. So, you know, growing up in America, right? Like your skin is too dark, you're this. I'm still learning to love myself. I'm realizing that there is beauty in each and every person and every individual. And I don't know where that moment of like, this is where what you have to do. You know, I think back to college and not being accepted into sort of the Black Student Union and realizing I have to be blacker or I have to stand out in black spaces. But then queer identity became something that came later. Like, when was it that I felt like I had to just sort of openly be queer? You know, I think even I remember working at a former, I was an admissions officer and working at a college university. And I sent a note about the fact that I was on a contest to be America's Gay Bachelor to my team, the admissions team. And my boss said, don't ever do that again. And I was like, what did I do? And I was shocked, but yet people could talk about, you know, Girl Scout cookie selling and going to church bake-offs, but I was not allowed to do that. So I don't know if that moment was a catalytic moment for me to say, you know what, I'm never going to not do that. I think, because I still continue to shy away from my identity. I think what I do understand, though, is that as we move up into positions of power or authority or feel like we have more people listening to us, our capacity to step out into our truth shifts. Right, when people say you're in a position, so you should, I fully believe that. And I will say that, you know, the summer of 2020 was, you know, I was a powerful summer for me, where I realized that now was the moment for me to be able to say, sure, right? Like, I should lean into yes more, especially about my identity. You know, maybe it was me becoming a father, you know, here was my child and I wanted to make sure she grew up in the best world. You know, I think for me, the solidification of my thesis statement, you know, probably came in the summer of 2020, right? Like the solidification of it. Like I probably always knew it was coming. I knew exactly, I was doing the work of the work. And maybe it was a little bit of me doing my own consulting work on myself and realizing I needed to boil it down to something. You know, but I think since that summer, I've been able to vocalize it and verbalize it in a very succinct way. But yeah, so I don't know. It's still a journey of learning to love yourself, learning to understand that you're working to make the spaces that you feel discomfort in more comfortable. I think it's self-acceptance is sort of, to me anyways, is this journey of unlearning, especially for Black and Brown folks, so much history that told us not to love ourselves.
Yeah. This might be a deep question, so you don't have to answer it.
I'm ready.
But I'm just curious to know, given your positions of authority that you've gained over time and all the work that you've done, why do you still like feel uncomfortable with your identity at times? Like, and what part of your identity do you sometimes feel uncomfortable with?
I think for me, it's, and maybe for others, it's the continued perception concern. Actually, I think the speaker right before this talked a little bit about this towards the end of it. I think it's other people, right? Like there's this perception, the bias. I think he was talking about bias. Like you are so concerned about, at least for me anyway, how other people are feeling or thinking in spaces and not wanting to make people feel discomfort. But again, pushing yourself, myself, to remember that their discomfort is ultimately not my problem, but I do have the opportunity to help them through that discomfort. You know, that I can be a safe space for people, which is something that I think I have the capacity for more than other folks. I do feel like I have more capacity for safe space time. I think my friends will probably tell you, my coworkers and colleagues would say, yes, he does. Like he gives more of that safe space time than other people would. I'm not quick to sort of react in a fiery way, but I want to make sure that again, people have that opportunity to be safe, to ask questions, to learn in spaces. So I think that's, you know, I have this capacity for taking more of that on.
Yeah. No, thank you for that. So. Now, let's move on a little bit. Okay. So we're going to get into the academic work. Prior to becoming a founder and working with Stonewall Columbus and Pride Fund One, you worked primarily in the academic space in college admissions and communication and outreach. How did your work in the academic space affect the way you think about leadership and also identity? And what led to the shift in your career? away from academics?
That's a lot. I mean, I love academia. I grew up in it. I learned a lot from it. I started out as an admissions officer recruiting students to my alma mater. And I was the diversity recruiter, right? Like I didn't start off that way. They asked me to become the diversity recruiter. And I remember this was during the time, how many times ago that we went through working through diversity and admissions and the Michigan ruling. Like, I mean, this was a number of years ago that this conversation was happening about it. And I remember being so adamant that I didn't want to be called the director of something admissions. I can't remember what the title was at the time, because I was like, I don't want to be, I was afraid of being pigeonholed as the only thing that you can do for the rest of your life is recruit multicultural students to a college or university. Like, you know, and that's what you saw. Anytime you saw a black or brown person in academia, in administration, they were the director of multicultural admissions or the director of multicultural student affairs. They weren't in other areas or spaces of academia, you know, where I think I wanted to exist. And so I stepped into that role and pushed and sort of pushed and expanded their understanding of what multicultural admissions looked like, right? Or what that definition was. And that was exciting for me because, as I said earlier, you know, when I started at the school, I felt like a raisin in a bowl of cream of wheat. You know, and when I sort of left the institution, you know, you felt more like a bowl of oatmeal, right? Like you felt and saw different texture and feeling. And it wasn't just because they said, well, let's bring in a lot of black students. It was, let's understand what diversity and inclusion means to create a space that was accepting of people. And so that was exciting for me. But I wanted to stay in admissions because I realized at that time that people that looked like me, that thought like me, were not considered or being recruited from some of these institutions like they should be. So for me, it was, you know, finding out ways to get into inner city schools, to get into schools where sometimes you would have underrepresented students that people weren't aware of, to make sure that they saw folks saying, you can be at these institutions and you should be at these institutions. So I think, you know, that was the driving force for me in admissions, is, again, to make sure that it was a diversity of people that were coming and being considered for these roles. But I think during that time, I also learned and saw the challenges of education, academia, and how black and brown folks were sort of tracked into different spaces, right? Like you were not sort of encouraged to go into business for the most part, right? Like there were these sort of tracks of academic experience or learning or professionalism that you could do post. And that was also not okay for me to be a part of that. So I think a lot of that work in academia that I spent doing was that. I went out to the West Coast and worked at Stanford University and worked there for a little bit. Worked in a higher education, sort of a feeding school, private high school in the city. And then came back to Columbus to continue to make sure that people were considering different types of identities in academia. I think, you know, as we talked about sort of the pipeline to venture capital, sort of being in these certain spaces, only types of identities being in there, that was important for me to help break that cycle. And I left academia because I just saw the opportunity to, again, to live my thesis and step into spaces that I wasn't seeing myself again.
So was it chronologically that you did the academic thing, then you started the consulting firm, then Stonewall, then Pride, or like, can you give us...
They kind of merged together, but yes. I mean, honestly, it did really just kind of happen that way. So I started advising some tech companies, startups, when I was living in San Francisco, working as an admissions officer in ed tech. And then when I came back to Columbus, really leaned more into tech advising and venture. And my consulting work, and then sort of slowly started to chip away at other things. So I left higher education, did some marketing solely, and found more capacity and space to do other things. So the flexibility of my job allowed me the opportunity to be able to do more consulting, to sit more into venture and to learn more of those concepts. And then the moment I left my job fully in 2020, January 2020, everything else sort of exploded.
Very nice. Yeah. Okay. So before we leave academia, do you ever believe you'll go back?
I mean, maybe, I think I sit on the board of my college, right? So I went to Kenyon College, and so sitting on the board of an academic institution keeps me involved in it. A number of folks think I should go back and get my PhD, but I don't have any interest in sitting back in the classroom again.
Yeah.
As a student.
I'm sure the work you do now is giving you a lot of joy.
A lot of joy. And it feels like teaching. It's a lot of teaching.
So just a couple more questions and we'll open it up to the audience if anyone wants to come up and ask a question. The work you do at Stonewall Columbus and Pride Fund One are different in many ways. How do these two roles inform each other? What does it tell you about the work that needs to be done within the LGBTQ plus community for equity to be achieved?
So when I said yes to Stonewall and yes to the Pride Fund, also the summer of 2020, I started saying I was a professional gay. And I think the great thing is that I'm paid, right? Again, it's one of these things where growing up as a young child, you would never think that you'd get paid to be something that you innately are. And that's a phenomenal thing. So that gives me immeasurable joy. And I think it is a wonderful intersection, right? Like I get paid to ensure that queer identities are seen, that they have space to celebrate themselves, that I get to, you know, visit amazing places and speak around the country about identity and why it's important to see people as individuals. So I think that, I mean, that's a phenomenal opportunity to ever step into and exist in. And they automatically inform each other. And I think what I've seen about equity in this particular space, but I think probably comes more from the lens of as a Black person being the executive leading these organizations, is that, again, continually brown identities are not in these spaces. So even though, you know, I step into this work and lead from the queer identity, it is the brown spaces and the Black identities that continually are not what I see, and also why I continue to show up and do the work.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. Last question. What is the work that you feel needs to be done to make tech spaces more equitable for Black LGBTQ plus members? And what are you proud to say you achieved within the space?
I mean, I think representation matters. I know that seems really simplistic, but I think what needs to be done in this space is that there needs to be a variety of types of identities that are presented. There isn't one cookie cutter Black founder. There isn't one cookie cutter Black company, right? And I think that's there's a model or a methodology that I think people have in their minds about what Black tech should look like, and I think we need to. I think that just needs to change, which is again the conversation about representation and why it matters so much. I think in the venture space when I started, which seems again so it's only 3 years ago when you think about the where the company is and how long it's come. We were the only LGBTQ focused venture capital fund in the country. There are others that have it as a subset or aspect of it or an identity of my underrepresented populations, but we were the only one. And so the joy for me is that there now is another one. Right, so there are at least two of us that we're aware of. Right, there could be more, but I think that is joyful to know that, and it's also led by a brown executive at the time. Right, that was exciting for me. Right, to say that now there are two LGBTQ venture capital funds in the country thinking about queer founders, thinking about queer ventures, and investing in their thoughts and their ideas.
Yeah, so in summary, you stepped out and you were the first fund focused on LGBTQ plus communities, which is huge. So thank you, Denzil, for your time and for sharing. I know we had some deep questions and I'm glad that you were able to be open with everyone here. I'll open it up to the audience if anyone wants to ask any questions. We have Denzil here. This is a special time, so come on up if you're interested. Don't be shy, guys. Come on. I'm looking at some of you. I see you. You don't have a question right here? Oh, okay. She has a question.
Hi, thank you so much for sharing. I'm so glad to be in Cincinnati and to experience this. And so I first wanted to apologize on the behalf of church not being a safe space for you. I think Jackie Hill Perry has done an excellent job. She wrote the book, Gay Girl, Good God, and that has done some work in informing and educating those of us who don't have same-sex desire. So I was curious with the fund, do you also, with people who have same-sex desires but might not actively walk or, you know, live the lifestyle of queer, would they still be able to be supported? Because there's a lot of depression and there's a lot of suicide that I think I'm just personally so disgusted by. And I've watched that it seems like the Black man has been such a marketing tool for the community as far as entertainment and monetizing. However, those monies have not supported the mental health issues and the trauma that they experience. So I was just curious if the church that is working to create safe spaces for people with the same-sex desires, and they have people who have businesses, how would they qualify for that?
And thank you for that question, and thank you for speaking on it. You know, you are correct, and I think it's interesting. I was thinking about this morning. Black men in particular have been monetized in a very interesting way, more so for entertainment than for our thought and our capacity to do other things, which again is why representation matters, which is why I do this work. In terms of the Pride Fund specifically, you know, I think we are open to considering all identities that identify as queer or LGBTQ, regardless of what they do in the privacy of their own home. For us, the importance in that particular moment, however, is the identification of such, right? So if someone says, this is the community I exist within, what you do at home is your own business. That's again, part of the things I'm fighting for is to keep your privacy of your own home. Like whatever you do at home is your business. Your mind, your capacity to be a business leader, to be amazing in your space should be what's respected. So I think for us as an organization, it's ultimately how you publicly identify and are okay with that, because that's going to be part of the story. And if you can step into that space.
Hello, good afternoon. My name is Yamilet Payano, and I'm the CEO and co-founder of Science Week. I have a question surrounding, right, a lot of minority founders right now are being funneled, I think, to accelerators, right? And we often are like, okay, that 120 grand or 500K seems very fantastic at the start of our company, but then we realize that we gave 10%, 6%, right, for an amount that realistically could have come from funds like yours, right? So when we're looking about aligning our thesis to funds like yours, especially when you're starting off, what would be some of the advice that you can tell a founder, okay, look for these things in a website before you reach out to a fund that would increase your likelihood of getting funding in a traditional way rather than being funneled into these accelerators?
So I think I would challenge the way that you're asking the question or going about doing the work, and that will allow you to find the right kind of fund. Because I think if you are looking for a fund and then sort of finding the language to change to that, then that's not probably what you should be doing. You want to find something that's already speaking your language, right? So you're identifying something that is speaking to your thesis in a way that you feel like, oh, I'm not changing anything about who we are. We're literally just telling you our story, and that's the exciting part, right? So when the ventures that we've engaged tell us their story, we're getting excited because often this is their authentic story, right? Like I was challenged in this space because I was queer and I couldn't get this funding, and this is what happened. My venture is great. Look at this, right? Like it's and sometimes the venture itself is about a queer identity, but it necessarily doesn't have to be. But I think if you're going somewhere and then trying to change yourself to it, then that's not okay, right? So look for organizations, ventures that are the companies, right, that are saying something that is already speaking to you, right? Not necessarily that just because it allows you a certain identity to get funding from it, right, that you look for it. Like start there, but if it's not speaking to you, just don't lean into it. Because then you all will have the problem where, you know, those venture companies will come back and expect something of you that you're like, I don't want to do that. I've just given you this percentage of my organization, and now you want me to do something that I don't want to do. That's because from the beginning, your thesis and their thesis didn't really exist together.
Got
And Yamalet, I want to add something. It's good to see you. I know her. She's pitched me before. So Yamalet, you know, you're doing work with, for the DHH community.
Yeah.
And I think that first finding other founders serving the same community, and I'm sure you've done this work because I know you've been at it for a while.
Yeah.
You know, obviously talking to their investors, if you haven't done that yet, and then obviously finding investors that are specific to DHH, and then finding investors that are specifically focused on underserved communities. So like Denzil has mentioned, I think that those types of investors will understand your story better and will probably resonate with the problem you're solving a little bit more. So I think that, yeah, going the accelerator route is probably what you had to do earlier on, but leaning a little bit deeper into finding investors that fit your thesis by looking at companies.
Your network.
Yeah, looking at similar companies or companies serving the same community as you are and looking at their investors, or talking more to founders who've built in your space. Even some founders that have built in your space that maybe have never raised venture capital have enough money to invest.
Mm-hmm.
So it might not only just be looking at VCs, you could also look at angels that understand that you want to keep equity in your company,
mm-hmm.
but have the money to invest.
And they're also going to tell you the companies to stay away from, right? Like to say, they invested in us, but we didn't, you know, we don't think that's a good one to work
yeah.
with. They will tell you that.
So. Yeah, exactly.
Hello, I'm Marcia Thornton. I'm the head of supplier diversity at The Hartford. So I'm here representing corporates and really just here to identify opportunities to collaborate and partner. So the Hartford is a corporate member of NGLCC. And I was just interested in learning if there is a formal partnership with the Pride Fund and if you will be at NGLCC in Denver next month.
So we actually do work very closely with NGLCC, and some of our initial sort of ventures and conversations about funders have come through that. We've done a couple of presentations with them in San Francisco and Chicago, I think, as well. So familiar with them and likely to engage deeper. Also on the Stonehill hat, we also have a partnership with them as well. I will not be there this year, however, but love to chat after and talk some more.
Okay.
And very familiar with Hartford, so thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you everyone for coming up and asking your questions. Denzil, thank you for your time. It was so special.
Thank you. I was glad to be here and be in conversation with you. So thank you so much.
Absolutely.
That was Denzil Porteous, a builder, a truth teller, and living proof that your identity is your superpower. Whether he's moving capital, leading nonprofits, or just being present with family, Denzil's showing us what it means to live your thesis in real time. If this hits home for you, subscribe to Road to Black Tech Week. Drop us a review, and send this episode to someone who's still figuring out how to show up fully. And yes, come through in person. Black Tech Week 2025 is where Vision gets funded. July 14th through the 16th, visit blacktechweek.com. Until next time, stand in your story, build with boldness, and live your thesis.